This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Tim's just told me this is him in Libya. And without further ado, I'm delighted to say that Tim isn't in Libya. He's here for day four of the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. Please welcome to the stage, ladies and gentlemen, Tim Marshall.
Morning. Morning, thank you very much. Thank you for that terrific introduction. Some of it was true. Breaking news, it's 133,001. Because Hazel has just bought another copy, so God bless you, Hazel. Thank you very much. Those reviews were terrific. Reminded me of the Groucho Marx quote. He was sent a book in the 20s by someone he didn't like, a comedy book to review, and he sent it back with a letter saying, "Thank you for sending this book to review. From the moment I picked it up until the moment I put it down, I couldn't stop laughing. I must read it sometime." One of my favourites. I wrote this book because, sadly, we are back in an age where we understand that nationalism is pretty much front and centre, and that's not peaked yet. So it's important to understand the symbols that push us, push our emotions and pull us. And like Prisons of Geography, the maps there were a vehicle to drive through ideas and drive through the history of a country and the culture of a country. And so is the flags. And I think that both maps and the symbols are often underreported in the business I used to be in. So, again, it is a book about flags, but it is also a book about current affairs and about history and about ideas and nationalism. Flags are maybe 2,500 years old. I mean, essentially, they're 50,000 years old. If somebody stuck something on the top of a stick, like somebody's head, I mean, essentially, it's a flag, it's a symbol, it's saying something, it's sending a message. But flags as we know them, 2,500 years ago, silk. Could you imagine having a flag made of cloth with paint on it? It's getting pretty heavy by now, and then it rains, you're going to fall off the back of your horse. You invent silk, now it's mobile. And they took it through the silk route to the Chinese. The Arabs thought this was a good idea. We then encountered the Arabs during the Crusades, and that's when Europe began to pick up the habit about 1,000 years ago. So, let's start with the imagery and the power. Some of you will know that's Iwo Jima, the statue in Washington of that famous moment when the Marines hoisted the Stars and Stripes on top of Iwo Jima. And I just put it up there as an example of the real power of symbolism. It's just a statue with a flag, and yet behind it is so much depth. And I think flags are a little bit like paintings. You know, you can read them, and you can both read into them things from yourself and get from them. You know, it's a two-way process, like a work of art. The Soviets were doing it as well. That was when they raised it over the Reichstag, made it into a stamp. That's about the most iconic use of a flag possibly ever. And this is the one that we know, and many of us love it, and some of us don't. And to the Americans, it obviously speaks volumes. And the first thing it does is it says their history. The 13 stripes, you see, are because there were 13 colonies that had the temerity, the damn brass cheek, to suggest to us that we couldn't be in charge of them any longer. And these 13 colonies took on the Brits and kicked them out. And at the time, there was a flag by the Sons of Liberty, which has subsequently been adopted by the Tea Party. So, you know, there's a direct line in history going on here. The Sons of Liberty had a very similar flag. So that was one of the ones, more or less, they fought under in the Revolutionary War. And so that's what they came up with in 1776. Of course, at the time, they only had 13 stars. And then the flag law said they were going to have an extra stripe as each state joined. It's not going to look good, is it? So they came up with this idea. And it's now 50, and it's going to stay 50 for the foreseeable future. What happens if California leaves in 100 years? Well, all right, they can make it 49. But that flag says birth of a republic, and it says to them freedom, because the 13 stripes were the colonies that were fighting for freedom. So it goes very, very deep. And you know that if you've been there, it's from sea to shining sea. They feel about their flag in an overt way the way the British may feel about theirs in a quieter way, and it is completely normal to fly it outside your front house, completely normal to stick it out of your window, and it does not necessarily have any negative connotations. We've had a debate, haven't we, in this country in the 70s and 80s about the use of our own flag, which was partially hijacked for a few years. You'll be familiar with "Oh Say Can You See by the Dawn's Early Light," by the rocket's red glare and the bombs bursting in air. Was the flag still there? That's the flag that it's referring to. We'd been and burnt down the White House. We weren't content with that. We were about to bombard Fort McHenry. This is 1815. And a bloke called Keyes rode onto one of our warships and said, "Can I please have some of the prisoners you've got? You don't need them." And the captain said, "Yes, but first I have to bombard this place." So Keyes stood on the deck and he wrote these lines as he watched the rocket's red glare and the bombs bursting in air, ending in the morning with, "Was the flag still there?" And yes, it was, because the bombardment didn't work. And that was so popular, they did the equivalent of photocopying it, and they distributed his poem all over the states. It became very popular, and eventually in the 1920s became the national anthem. So again, in their anthem is the reference to the flag, and it all comes together. We'll see it tonight, those of you who are going to watch the Super Bowl, which starts at 11 o'clock-ish, so maybe we won't. But it all comes together at their sporting events. With sound. Sometimes. Sometimes not with sound. Depends if the engineer is putting the fader up. But if he isn't, there's not going to be any sound. If he is, he's going to put the fader up.
At the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming. And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the
iconography, power, symbolism, patriotism, it's all rolled up in one, and it's all rolled up in a little piece of cloth that you put paint on. And it is because it's what you invest in it and also what it says to you. I was very taken with that because that is the bringing together of the things we've been talking about. They have, in the military, a view of the flag that is not shared by the British military, but they take it so seriously that if it's tattered or torn, they retire it. They give it a decent burial or a cremation. They actually cremate their flags in the military. I've been to Arlington Cemetery a few times for the funerals of Marines or soldiers killed in Afghanistan and Iraq, and you've probably seen the ceremony where they fold the American flag up many, many times, starting with it complete and ending as the last fold is the fold of daylight, the stripes, into the stars of night, at which point it's in a triangular shape or a cockade. And that is because, of course, in the War of Revolution, they wore cockade hats. And so, again, it all comes together. It goes very, very deep, and it means an awful lot to many people in many ways. Now, there are Americans that think these people should be prosecuted. They can't be, not only because they're in Pakistan, but also because it is not illegal to burn the American flag. Now, it used to be during the Vietnam War when it got burnt a lot, and then they decided, no, it was illegal, because it was getting burnt so much. In 84, a young Texan student burnt it. He was sentenced to a year in jail. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, took 4 years, 88. And the Supreme Court ruled, no, it's not illegal. He cannot go to jail for this. Why? Because under the First Amendment, freedom of speech, the flag speaks to you, it communicates to you, and consequently burning it is a form of communication. Consequently, his rights to burn it are underpinned by the First Amendment. It says a lot about the flag, and it says a lot about the freedoms of America that are embodied in the flag, because I'm not talking about how things are actually carried out, but if you look at constitutions and the way, in law, America is a lot freer than nearly everywhere, including this country. It's a lot more open and has a lot more freedoms than we do, for example. Freedom of Information Act notwithstanding. Moving on. You may think this is the flag of the European Union. It's not. It's the flag of the Council of Europe. Because the Council of Europe, late 40s, early 50s, came up with this idea. And they were going to have 14 stars for each member. And the Saarland, which at the time was to be determined between the Germans and the French, was one of the stars. And of course, the Germans who wanted it back said, well, we can't have a star representing them, because politically, once you've established something like that, you're on your way to being independent if you're recognized on there. This is why these symbols matter and they're deeply political. And the French said, no, they must have it. And the compromise was to only have 13 stars. And the Italians said, that's unlucky. And this is a true story. Because the Italians said it was unlucky. That's why there's 12 stars. When the EEC came along, they thought, we need a flag. Copy and pasted the Council of Europe flag. And I spent a lot of time on the phone and emailing Brussels saying, is that the EU flag? And it's not. It's a symbol of the European Union. Yes, is it the EU flag? Well, it identifies with the values of the... Yes, is it an EU flag? There's a problem if you call it a flag, because it might be a nation-state flag. And if it's a nation-state flag, does it have parity with the nation-state? And if it has parity with the nation-state, we better have a referendum. Politics, identity, it goes very deep. Whenever I used to travel, if I went through a city square, I'd say, oh, who's that? And you'd learn something about the great leader from their past that was a bedrock of their identity. And if I saw a flag, I'd say, well, what's the history of it? And you get these bedrock ideals of what they all know instinctively, and you only learn by going there and sometimes by living there to really understand a country. Another thing is the humor. Always try to understand the humor of a country. Not always easy. No, I won't go there. Like I said, I always used to... And then when you've got that bedrock of their identity and their feelings, when an event happens, you can simply bolt it onto your foundation of understanding, and it's much easier to get context of what's going on then. Is a pattern emerging? We'll disregard the bottom one for reasons that some of you will know. It's a Scandinavian cross, as you know, and it was the only grouping of flags I could find in the whole of the European continent, which I found interesting for a number of reasons. One, simply for design. It also, when you go into why, tells you about the history of Scandinavia and their shared history. For example, you know, when did Sweden own Denmark? When did Denmark own Iceland? You know, you learn the history and the politics, and that's why their flags are so similar. But also what struck me was this is the most overt use of the Christian symbol in the least Christian part of the continent. And it's partly to do with the fact that they still have queens and king, royal families, some of them, so they're not republics necessarily. But it just struck me as ironic, because church attendance there is the lowest anywhere on the continent, and yet they are the ones that have held on to the Christian symbol. You see it everywhere, don't you? And immediately you know what you're getting. You are getting tomato, mozzarella, and basil. And I say that as a joke, but also I mean it. What fantastic branding. The most successful branding probably for food of any nation state flag. America, Thousand Stripes, you're probably thinking burgers. The British flag, boiled cabbage. the Algerian flag, nothing, not even couscous. But when you go out into the world and you see that those three colours in that order, you immediately brand with Montepulciano, Vespa, AC Milan, and other Italian things. Piaggio. A tricolore salad. It is a fantastic piece of branding. The history of it is simply that when Napoleon invaded, the Milan militia fought under a flag like that instead of the Transpennine Republic. And so after the Risorgimento, they thought, well, that worked. We'll have it for the whole country. Your starter for 10, anyone? Yes. Collect 76 free books on their way out. But I haven't signed that contract, so... Yes, Macedonia. I've put it here for a number of reasons. One, it is so un-European, although it actually is very European, which I'll come back to. It completely stands out on its own. The other is, it's one of my favourite flags. But the real reason is it underpins the politics of symbolism. It's not actually the Macedonian flag, even though we would all call it that, and we would all say, I've been to Macedonia, if you had been. But you would never say, I have been to the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, which is its name. There is no such country as Macedonia, because there's a very large part of Greece, the top right-hand side, which butts onto the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. And so if you were to accept that there is a nation-state called Macedonia, well, they might want a little bit more nation-state, and then a bit more nation-state. Now, it might sound childish, but the Greeks leant on their EU partners and said, no way in hell are we going to recognise Macedonia. And the compromise, it would be called the Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. Secondly, the first flag they came up with was very similar to this. And it was Alexander the Great's symbol. Now, as you all know, Alexander the Great was a Greek or a Macedonian. If you're Greek, he was Greek. If you're a Macedonian, he was a Macedonian. He was a split personality, clearly. Does it matter? It matters enormously if you want to hang on to a large part of your territory, because you cannot admit that he was Macedonian. If he was, I'm not saying he was for a moment. He might have been. So he has to be Alexander the Great. Consequently, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, former Republic of Yugoslavia, called Macedonia, cannot have that symbol. So again, they lent on the EU, and the EU lent on the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. You can see why we call it Macedonia. And they compromised, and this is another one of Alexander the Great of wherever's symbols. So it sounds sort of silly and childish and petty, but it's not. It's actually really, really important and can lead to great amounts of trouble if you don't get the politics of this sort of stuff right. It's like when you see on the news when there's people having news conferences and there's flags behind them. They have to be in the right order, at the right height. One can't be higher than another. And they all take it very seriously. And again, it sounds childish. But if you let stuff slip, and you let something else slip. Now, going slightly off subject, South China Sea. The entire region is watching what the Americans and the Chinese do. If on the next confrontation there is, and there's been several in the Obama years, and Obama did not blink on most of them, if America starts to blink each time over what looks like a small issue of an island that is being built with concrete to create sovereign territory, theoretically, fine, they back off, and then they back off, and then they back off. All the neighbours are watching these individual small incidences, and they're all thinking, if they're going to back off, we are going to get closer to China. If they don't back off, they're going to stay with America. So all these small incidents that you think, why do they care so much? It's that sort of thing. That's why they care so much. By the way, Skopje Airport is called Alexander the Great Airport. And there's a statue of him on a horse in the arrivals hall. And you go down Alexander the Great Boulevard to get into the capital. His name escapes me for the moment. Skopje, yeah. Arab Flag of Revolt, 1916. The embodiment of the Arab unity ideal, all reflected in there. Allegedly, T.E. Lawrence had a hand in it. Sykes, of Sykes-Picot, allegedly had a hand in it. And King Hussein, the great-great descendant of the current King of Jordan, that the red was for him. What it does is it brings together the three great Islamic dynasties, Umayyad, Abbasid, Fatimid. The Fatimids, for example, were green. They were the Shia dynasty, which is why Iran has a lot of green in its flag, because it's a Shia-dominated country. So you were bringing together the three great Islamic dynasties and saying, we are all one. And it worked for about half an hour, and then it split. There wasn't enough to hold them together. The language wasn't enough. The divisions divided them. But you can still see it in the modern Arabic flags, this concept, this idea of where they are and what they are. And there's the Jordanian flag, because the Hashemite Hussein, who had the idea of having the whole of Arabia as one kingdom, ended up with Jordan. And the seven-sided star is for the seven hills of Amman. There's the Iraqi flag with Allah Akbar written across it. The Egyptian flag with the eagle of Saladin, who was Kurdish. The greatest ever Arabic hero was a Kurd. The Libyan flag, Yemen, Palestinian flag, and as you know, half of the Jordanian population is Palestinian. And if they ever do join, it's only a question whether you have the star or not. And the Syrian flag, but that depends on which side you're on, whether you have two stars or three stars. The ISIS flag is so different. It screams 6th century. It screams original. None of this fancy nonsense 21st century rubbish. We're the original boys who behave in the original way. The way the Shahada, the profession of faith, there is no God but God and Muhammad is his prophet, is written in the way it would have been written perhaps in the 6th century. That's the seal of Muhammad in the top. You can see it in the Topkapi Museum. So, and it's square and it's black. And it's thought Muhammad's flag was black. So what they're doing with that is saying to people that might buy into them, we're the originals. We're not these sophisticated people who bought into nation states. We believe in one for everybody. And when you add that to their terror, it works. Because as soon as you see that flag, you know what you're getting. And we've all seen what they do. It's brilliant. For example, when they approached Mosul 2 years ago and flew that flag, everyone ran away. It's a brilliant piece of branding. The other thing about it is, unlike Al-Qaeda, they actually took territory. So they can say to everybody, we're the boys, never mind the old guys. Never mind bin Laden. And there's a saying, I think it's a hadith, that the black flags shall appear from Khorasan and appear in Dabiq. And when you see them, you should crawl over broken ice to get to them, because there will be the Messiah. And Dabiq is a village near Raqqa in Syria, where the end of day's battle will take place. And they actually put the flag up, hundreds and hundreds of them, in Dabiq. They fulfilled the prophecy, unlike AQ, Al-Qaeda. So the power of seeing that flag made their true believers think, history's on our side. Now, Dabiq has fallen, Mosul will fall, Raqqa will fall probably end of this year or next year. But the fact remains that the symbol of the flag, they can still say, we fulfilled history. Chinese flag's fascinating. It not only screams communism at you, but the big star is for the party. And the party overshadows and takes care of and guides the four categories of the Chinese people. The peasants, the proletariat, the bourgeoisie, and the patriotic capitalists. Very far-seeing, those communists, weren't they, in the 1950s? The patriotic capitalists, of which there are now 1.4 billion. Great piece of marketing. And I was in Beijing recently. You see this flag more than you used to. You see President Xi's face more than you used to. There's a cult of personality emerging around the symbolism of the iconography. Well, we could do an hour on this. It's the Ethiopian flag. That's the seal of Solomon. Solomon was descended from the house of David. Solomon took a shine to the Queen of Sheba in Ethiopia. They had a child. Their child was the first emperor. If you fast forward 230 generations, you get to Haile Selassie, who is ever fearful, ever living, Selassie I, Rastafari. You may have heard him if you like Bob Marley. The Rastas think he's God, haven't yet died. Why? Because of the house of the Lion of Judah, Solomon was from the house of David. It is prophesied that the Messiah will either come or come back, depending on which flavor you are, from the house of David. It follows that if Solomon was from the house of David, the 240th descendant is from the house of David, and if you believe Marcus Garvey, the black intellectual of the 20th century, who prophesies that a prince will come from the east, which is where Ethiopia is, you arrive at the idea that Haile Selassie was God. I mean, it's no more nutty than any other theory you could come up with for other religions, for example, Scientology. So that explains why the Rasta flag is the old Ethiopian flag. The new ones who were communists in the 70s when they took over couldn't have symbols of royalty, so they put that in. But the real point of this is red, gold, and green. Those of us of a certain age remember Culture Club and their lyrics. They're always banging on about red, gold, and green. So was Bob Marley. Ethiopia was the only country not fully colonized. A lot of people took a lot of inspiration from that. And so when you get to the beginnings of independence, a lot of people took inspiration from the colors of Ethiopia and from the teachings of Marcus Garvey, who was a Jamaican. And the Prime Minister, for example, of Ghana was a huge devotee of Garvey. And so when he became Prime Minister of Ghana, the first African country to get independence, the Black Star is for the Black Star Liner, Garvey's shipping company that he formed to take black people back to Africa. And they've just lost in the semi-finals of the African Cup, and they're called the Black Stars, the Ghanaian football team. So it all comes together there, the red, gold, and green, and the black, Marcus Garvey's prophecies. And there's a link between that, going back 2,500 years, all the way to Solomon and the House of David. Garvey is buried in Jamaica. That's why the Jamaican flag is the color it is. Garvey and Africa and Ethiopia. I'm going to have to rattle on now, because if that clock's correct, it's almost 1:30. Not the Italian flag, the Mexican flag. This predates the Italian flag by a long way. What's interesting about it is that in the middle there is an Aztec symbol. It's one of the very few flags in Latin America to acknowledge the existence of its past. And I have a theory that the African flags rejected a lot of European influence, and you could understand why after it had only been 50 years, 100 years of colonialism, and they rejected a lot of the European influence because their culture, their language was intact. In Latin America, 90% of the population was wiped out. So by the time you get to independence, everyone is either Spanish or Portuguese speaking. There's a little bit that speaks English. And you're mostly Christian and Catholic, so you look back to the old world, and that's why most of their flags are more redolent of Europe than the African ones are. That's the Wapala, an old ancient Andean flag going back 1,000 years. Very unusual. Predates the Rubik's Cube by 1,000 years. It's square. And Bolivia, the president of Bolivia, Morales, has put into law that that has parity with the Bolivian flag. And that's quite a political statement. And he's from an indigenous population of Bolivia. And it flies at parity in the government buildings, in the schools, in the universities. And it's spreading through the Andes at the moment as a symbol of, hey, remember us? You know, you've got to understand that we are part of this society. That is a fantastic piece of branding, only 30 years old, swept through the world. And what does it tell you about our culture, that we can fly that in all our capital cities? And what does it tell you about the cultures where if you even put it out the front window, the place would be burnt down? It tells you an awful lot. 5 continents, 7, but there was 5 when the flag came up in the early part of last century for the Olympics, and they're all connected. Lovely symbolism. Mars attacks, certainly designed by a chap from Mars, and looks like we're right in the crosshairs. Why light blue? All the other colours had gone. This is how the book is structured. That's a fascinating read. I didn't know until the research. That only became popular, really popular, in the United States in the early 1950s. it was a battle flag in the Civil War, and I just assumed it had carried on through, but it didn't really, and it only really emerged as a popular symbol in the 1950s. We can have a long and heated argument about it being called the Union Jack, if you wish. What's it going to look like if you take that one out? I personally don't think that's going to happen, but we'd have to redesign it. And if we did redesign it, would we have to put that dragon in there somewhere? Because despite being a principality, that's just a word. Nation is also a word, and the Welsh know they are a nation. So would they really accept a redesigned flag if Scotland wasn't there, with nothing representing them? I doubt it very much. Politics, symbolism. That takes us through the Christian, mostly Europe, and some history. That's a very interesting one, of going for the symbolism. That's the Hezbollah flag, for example. Then we get East of Eden, which, as you know, was Mesopotamia. Lawn Tennis Association there. Lovely bit of artwork, the yin and yang of that part of the world. Latin America. That's an absolutely absorbing one, but you're going to have to buy a book to find out, because that was the hardest bit of research I had to do. And that's about that. Thank you very much. Thank you. We've got about 12 minutes, if there are any questions, which I hope there are. Yes, the hundreds.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Hi.
A quick question on your background. What's your best and worst moment as a foreign correspondent?
One of them's egotistical, the other one's very sad. There's lots of really best moments, but possibly finding out that President Clinton found out that the Russians had entered Pristina. Because I looked out my window and there was the Russian armoured column coming through Pristina, because nobody knew what was going on. Most of the comms were down. And I managed to phone it through. Couldn't get a satellite or anything. And I said, the Russians are in Pristina, the Russians are in Pristina. They got there first before the Yanks. And I later heard that that's how President Clinton found out that they'd made it there first. And it sort of there was another time when I mentioned something about a company. It was true, I had checked it. And about 2 hours later, the business section came over with a graph, and they said to me, you see that? And that, I said, yeah. They said, well, that at 10:05 is the share price, and that's the share price at 10:07. You've just cost them 17 million quid. I thought, okay, no pressure there then. I'm afraid the worst is the death of a colleague, Mickey Dean, who was shot in Egypt a couple of years ago. I mean, you know, it's when all those ego highs become meaningless. Sorry to end on a downer. Any others? Yes, sir.
When a newly independent country is looking to adopt a flag, is there an international body it has to consult or verify?
Who gets to decide the new flag of the new country? The new country does. Now, you then have to go through a process at the UN to register it. And let's say, for example, somebody decided to redesign this as the Nazi swastika. You know, the UN at that point might have something to say about it. But, you know, I can't imagine those circumstances. And so if we go to the South African flag, which is somewhere on there. Thank you. Yes, there. This was a lovely man called Fred designed this. There's a lovely story attached to it as well, actually. Mandela was out, they knew he was going to win the presidency, and they only had the apartheid era flags. Bit of a problem. You can hardly inaugurate the new president with the old apartheid flag. So they asked him to draw up a new one. They came up with loads and loads of designs. Eventually they sort of hit on it, and he's brought together all the colours of the major ethnic groups, including the orange. That was very important, because just because, you know, the Afrikaans and their orange, you have to include them. Otherwise, it's a recipe for disaster later on. So we put all the colours together, and they faxed it to Mandela. This is only about 3 weeks before Inauguration Day, and you need millions of these flags. And faxes are black and white. So Mandela sent this guy running off down the shops to get some crayons. They filled it in, and Mandela said, yep, fine. So the incoming president approved the design, obviously with all the ANC guys around him, and then they had to send off to the Dutch to make all the flags because they just didn't have time to run them up. Ran up X thousand or whatever flags, and on Inauguration Day, there they were. So the people and the country get to choose their own flag. It can be problematic. The Mozambique flag is the old flag of Frelimo, who won the civil war. And they mostly represented one of the major ethnic groups. And so they tinkered with the flag, but the other four major ethnic groups look at it and they're still seeing the flag of the ones that won the war. So they can be very problematic. But it's basically the country gets to choose. Sorry, it's a very long-winded argument.
I'd like to ask about countries choosing flags and New Zealand.
Ah, New Zealand, as you might know when you read the paper last year, they had a competition. Should they keep the Union Jack in their design? Or was it now time? I don't think I'm going to... Well, there, yeah, there we are. Was it now time to dump it? And so they had a referendum, and there was a significant vote to keep it. I loved the alternative. It was simply a black flag with a fern on it. Really quite striking. And, you know, they did the mass hacker in Westminster last night. I mean, you can imagine that there. A beautiful flag. I'm only theorising that if they do this in 25, 30 years, it'll go. But the historical memory of the current ethnic makeup is such that there are enough people that think, nah, I quite like that. Eventually, because more people from Indonesia and China and places are settling there, it'll go. I mean, it is an acronym. It is that spider that I can't pronounce. Any more?
Oh. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
I was in Cornwall recently, and I saw they use their county flag a lot. I was wondering if London had a flag, and what does it look like?
I don't know, but it almost certainly does. Yeah, the Cornish flag is the black one with the white on it, and regional identity remains very, very strong in this country, notably amongst the four major divisions, but then you can subdivide them all. I'm afraid I don't know, but it will have a flag at some point somewhere. I mean, Yorkshire, for example, where I'm from, people take their flag very seriously. I've got it tattooed on my arm. Yeah, that was when I was in the armed forces, and I don't know if you ever knew in the armed forces, the bit you don't read at the bottom of the contract where you sign your life away, as it says, at some point, when you're drunk, you must get a tattoo, otherwise you'll never get promoted. Time for two or three more.
Sorry, me again.
It's all right.
I have to confess, I haven't read your flags book, so I'm going to ask you another Prisoners of Geography question. Could you talk a bit about Putin's Russia? Do you think Putin's acting defensively, or he's trying to expand and attack, or do you think he just doesn't have a plan and does it spontaneously?
Oh, I think he absolutely has a plan, and I have been admonished many times in the past 10 years by saying he's a strategist, not just a tactician. I think he's a strategist. History flows in and out, doesn't it? And the tide comes in and the tide goes out. I personally think the tide of ever closer union has reached its furthest ashore and now is retreating, as viz us. So when you look through Russian history and you see it backwards and forwards and you see this flat land in front of it and they keep getting invaded, they were fighting once every 35 years in that flat ground. They will seek to dominate that flat land by any means necessary. So in that sense, they're sort of defensively, but for the wrong reasons. He's actually been quite aggressive, and you have to push the Russian borders up as close to the barbarians, that's us, as possible, to make sure they can't come and get you. And if you believe nationalistically, because he's an irredentist, that the Baltics are actually Russian and parts of Ukraine are actually Russian and Crimea is actually Russian, Yeah, he will, and he's done exactly that, and he is gathering them all in. I kind of understand it. If you go from the Baltic Sea to the Carpathians, it's only 300 miles wide, and that's the narrowest point of the flatland that comes all the way from France to the Urals. You will seek to push up and block that gap, even if it means ruling over people that don't want you to rule over them. I think they're very aggressive. I think they haven't finished yet. The only thing I worry about, amongst so many things we could worry about, Mr. Trump, is if he gives the nod to Putin about spheres of influence. That's your sphere. Don't care what you do there. Don't mess around with our sphere. Because if he does that, he might trigger Article 5, in which case you're just about old enough to get called up. And on that cheerful note, we've still got time for two more. It's going to be fine. Don't worry.
Hiya.
Hello.
In your Prisoners of Geography book, you mentioned about how the Russians had placed a flag near the Arctic.
That's right, yeah.
And I just wanted to know whether you thought maybe in the future there'd be an Arctic flag with the territories close, or even Antarctica.
Nice. Let me deal with Antarctica first. There is an Antarctica flag, and there's also, thankfully, an Antarctica treaty. Antarctica is, think of it as a pie chart, and there's tranches of it that various countries, including the UK, claim. Argentina claims some, lots of people claim it. Luckily, that treaty has not been touched for 50 years, and nobody wants to touch it. I don't think it's going to be torn up, people trying to drill. So I don't lie awake at night thinking about Antarctica. The Arctic, yeah, the Russians put a sub down, and this is the same as going to the moon and putting a flag and saying, that's ours. They put a sub down 3,000 feet and they've planted a titanium flag right in the middle of the Arctic Ocean to say, that's ours. They held a competition to rename the Arctic Ocean, and the winner was the Russian Ocean. They have a ridge, the Lomonosov Ridge, which sticks out from Siberia underwater. Everybody has got 200 EEZ, exclusive economic zone, from your shoreline. That's yours. If you've got a ridge, you've got 300 miles. So they're claiming more of it. I don't think there'll ever be a flag of the Arctic, no, but it is the coming diplomatic battleground, because for various reasons, including global warming, it is now getting more feasible to get to the stuff under the sea, the oil and the gas. America's got two icebreakers, Russia's got 30, and as Mrs. Clinton said, we've got villages in the Arctic, they've got cities. The Russians are two or three decades ahead in the coming race for the Arctic. Fighting up there, they are, like the Norwegians, really beefing up their army. They're putting in a lot more cold weather fighting infantry. Who the hell wants to fight up there? I honestly think that the Arctic can be done diplomatically. So you're all right. One more, if anybody has one.
Can I ask why most flags are rectangular, but the ISIS one, and you mentioned a couple of the others, like the indigenous one in South America, are square?
Mostly simply designed. They just look better. I think they do. I mean, the Nepalese flag is another exception. I mean, as you see, they are all rectangular, except for the ISIS one there. Ah, there it is. The Nepalese flag, that's the only flag in the world like that. These are the two peaks of Mount Everest for the Himalayas. These are all symbols which were both for the royal family, which after it got massacred, luckily they predate the royal family so they could keep them. So a very, very unusual flag. But as you see again, nearly all of them are rectangular, and I believe it is simply because of design. And on that bombshell, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim.